Welcome, welcome. I'm Carrie Goldberg. I cover health and science at WBUR, which is a media partner of the Boston Book Festival. And we are very honored to have with us two extraordinarily distinguished Harvard, which doesn't mean they're old, Harvard historians of science, Harvard historians of science, Professor Ann Harrington and Professor Naomi Oreskes. And Ann has written the book Mind Fixers, Psychiatry's Troubled Search for the Biology of Mental Illness. Naomi has written Why Trust Science, which is coming out just this week. So I think we'll begin with just a brief description of the book by each author, and then we'll get into conversation. Ann.
Thank you. I wrote Mind Fixers because I had been teaching the history of psychiatry to Harvard undergraduates for some time, a broad survey course in the history of psychiatry, and I was increasingly concerned that I wasn't really doing right by my undergraduates, many of whom were not just interested in the history of psychiatry for intellectual reasons, but because they suffered mentally. They brought personal, sort of histories into the course. And yet they had inherited a world of conversation and understanding around psychiatry that was deeply polarized. On the one hand, psychiatry presented itself to them as a medical discipline like any other, with its own treatments, its own research agendas. A lot of these students that I taught were thinking about going into medical school. Some of them even thought about becoming psychiatrists themselves. And yet, on the other hand, they inherited a world where there's a constant kind of drumbeat of skepticism about psychiatry, a kind of constant insinuation that don't believe the hype. Don't believe that, the drugs don't work, the drugs are dangerous, the psychiatrists don't really know what these diagnostic categories really are, and they don't... And yet the suffering remained. And so I became concerned to try to write a book or to try to understand for myself, first for my students, but then in a sense for everybody, including myself, how we ended up in this world. And it turned out that for me, a really critical moment was the 1980s. Because the 1980s was the decade, and actually it was less than a decade, it was just really in a period of 3 to 5 years when a psychiatry in the United States that had previously been overwhelmingly psychoanalytic pivoted so dramatically that people spoke at the time of a revolution. And yet, there was no radical or revolutionary new science to explain the pivot. And so then all of a sudden, the challenge of the book and the story I tell in the book is, why did it really happen? And that's what Mind Fixers is about. We can talk more about, but that's the crux, really, of the book.
Thank you, Ann, Naomi.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for being here tonight. So some of you know, in 2010, I published the book Merchants of Doubt with my co-author Eric Conway. That book tells the story of climate change denial and the way in which the same strategies and tactics were used over a long period of time to challenge the scientific evidence on a set of issues, sorry, this doesn't seem quite right. There we go. To challenge the scientific evidence on a set of environmental and public health issues that in the book we traced back to tobacco. And we showed that many of the strategies and tactics that were being used to try to discredit climate science and climate scientists had been developed originally by the tobacco industry. So when that book came out and it started to get attention, I went on the lecture circuit. I gave a lot of public lectures and pretty soon was being invited to go a lot of places to talk about climate change and climate change denial. And when I would give those talks, I always gave them from a historical perspective, from the perspective of our field, which is history of science. So I would give these very carefully crafted lectures, beginning in the 1899 with Svante Arrhenius, who first said that greenhouse gases could change the atmosphere. And then I would explain how scientists had studied the question extremely carefully and what kinds of experiments and observations they had done to culminate in this place where we were now, where scientists had a consensus that, yes, indeed, greenhouse gases were warming the atmosphere and we were to blame. So when I would give these public lectures, sometimes people would ask skeptical or hostile or even sometimes belligerent questions. And one time I was giving a talk, and at the end of the talk, a man stood up, rather aggressively, puffs up his chest, puts his hands on his hips, and he says, "Well, that's all very well and good, but why should we trust the science?"
Yeah.
And I remember standing there in that moment and thinking, fair enough. It's a good question. And yeah. So in that moment, the seed of this book was born. So like all good intellectual academic projects, it's taken a number of years to come to fruition, but the book is really an attempt to answer that question in a fair, principled, and hopefully readable way.
And persuasive.
Well, yeah, I'll let you say that.
Okay. So the order of the evening is we'll be talking for about 25 minutes or so, and that's also in particular time for you to start thinking of your questions. And so we'll get to questions a little over halfway through. So Anne and Uma were saying that your books are a little bit in conversation with each other, but I have to say that my impression, speaking bluntly, was that Anne's book basically is an extremely persuasive reason not to trust science, because it really does tell a story, particularly the Freudian aspect of it, that really seems like there were a lot of psychiatrists who tend to pull the science out of their butts. Like, it just kind of, there
I
was a lot
say
of,
that.
You don't say that, you don't say that, but I was like, wait a minute, they were just making this stuff up, a lot of it. And so I do think that the great challenge for Naomi is, given a history like that, why should we still trust science? So how do you respond?
So the way I would start off by responding is by saying that psychiatry is not just science. Psychiatry is about practices, and it's about suffering people. It's in more recent decades, it's about the pharmaceutical industry. It's tended to be, you know, very explicitly, broadly expansive in the kinds of problems that it takes on. And as you know, certainly if you want to go back to the Freudian era, part of the reasons the Freudian sort of crash and burn, I believe, is that they way overshot what they could take on after the Second World War, which is really when the Freudians sort of achieve pole position within the field, not earlier. Sometimes people say, talk about the Freudian century. It's really only after World War II. But when they do, they see themselves as now positioned to really manage all the societal problems of post-war, the Cold War era. Mm-hmm. And they don't even themselves think of themselves as particularly medical. They think, you know, they're dealing with racism. They're dealing with, our military preparedness. They're dealing with juvenile delinquency. So part of the answer is, maybe we need to turn to Naomi. So what gets to count as science?
Right.
Is it just people who have the label on their forehead? Or what counts as science?
Yeah, well, I think Anne and I should go on the road together, because I think we could have incredibly interesting conversations about this. So there's a few things, some of which we've already talked about, and I'll add a few more. So the first one I would underscore is what Anne just said about the distinction between science and medicine. Medicine uses science. Medicine includes science, but it's not restricted to science. And I think one of the big differences between science, sensu stricto, geology, physics, chemistry, evolutionary biology, versus medicine. In medicine, you have patients. You have people who come to you who are suffering, who are in pain, and need something. And that puts tremendous pressure on the medical community to do something. And
now.
So often, right. Now, right. Right, not to say come back in 3 years when we've sorted this out. And that's a huge intellectual and personal difference, because scientists can say, we haven't sorted this out yet, come back in a year or 2 years or 10 years. Doctors don't have that luxury.
But the psychiatrists were claiming that they knew.
Right, okay. Well, can I just say one more thing?
Of course.
The second part, though, of course, has to do with expertise. And in my book, one of the things I'm very clear about is I don't just say we should trust science broadly, blanket trust, faith, all that. It's about trusting scientists in their domains of expertise. And this is actually one of the things I stress very strongly. I absolutely think we should trust climate scientists about climate, evolutionary biologists about evolution. And this is incredibly important, because if you go on the internet or listen to, you know, right-wing talk radio, you'll hear all kinds of people attacking climate science who are not climate scientists. So that distinction is extremely important. However, as you just said, if the psychiatrists are giving us advice about racism or world peace, then that should be a giant red flag, right? Because now they're not just speaking to a finite domain in which they may have a strong claim for expertise, but they're making extremely broad claims way beyond their expertise. But and that, for me, is a big red flag.
But they were making problematic claims even in their expertise. Like, they were saying, you are mentally ill now because of your Oedipal complex from your feelings about your, you know, your mother when you were four. How do you respond to that? That's within expertise, supposedly.
Well, so we want to have a conversation about whether psychoanalysis is trash.
Yeah, I was just going to say. I mean, you made a pretty bold claim. That's my impression from reading it.
And it is the case that, you know, the hegemonic, sort of the Freudian hegemony only, you know, was about a 30-year period. But what I think is important to say before we, you know, it's in the 80s, everyone decided Freud was, you know, was a charlatan. And not only did they come to decide that Freud was a charlatan, but they came to decide that he was evil.
Really?
That he had been involved in cover-ups, particularly around the reality of childhood incest. The feminists hated Freud. Huge numbers of people piled on Freud.
But when you say everyone, though, I mean, there were still Freudian psychoanalysts. Let me just—I didn't mean everyone, of course.
I meant there was a lot of them. But after, you know, in World War II, you had a situation in which the biological psychiatrists are in decaying mental hospitals, giving shock to patients and lobotomies. And then you had a situation where the psychoanalysts are going off to war and working with the traumatized soldiers and doing things that appear to be truly therapeutic and humane on their behalf. And this allows them to emerge after the Second World War, they helped to win the war, they can now help to win the peace. And meanwhile, revelations about Nazi atrocities, and particularly about the ways that use certain kind of theories about the genetic basis of mental illness had led to not only involuntary sterilization, but outright murder. You know, was busy damning the biological sector of psychiatry in all sorts of ways, not just intellectual, but moral. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you put yourself in the position of what it looked like in the 1950s, who you're going to bet on, who they had both the empirical sort of results to show, they had helped the soldiers, and they had the moral high ground.
Yeah, and if I can jump in here, I mean, I think, so there's so many important issues because obviously, the work you do, the things you're looking at, there are so many elements that get conflated and they all play a role in the credibility of these claims and expertise. Mm-hmm. But one of the points I make in my book is to say, so what are the conditions under which we should trust science and what are the conditions under which we should be rightly skeptical? So the whole point of the book is to try to look at that in a principled way. And one of the things I come to is about consensus.
Right.
Because if I can just say, because one of the other things that I found when I was on the lecture circuit, besides the why should we trust science, sometimes people would say, and this is chapter two of the book, is the response to this question. So the first chapter responds to the first question. The second was, people would say, well, why should we trust science when we know that scientists are always getting it wrong? And when people would ask that, I would say, well, what are you thinking about in specific? Could you give me an example? And most of the times they could not. It was just a sort of general idea. Yeah. But if they had an example, it was always from one of two areas. It was either nutrition, much debated this last week, or it was medicine, usually psychiatry.
Yeah.
So the issue of these areas where we have conflict, disagreement, possibly things we would now discredit, are very, very important. And in the second half of the book, I look at that. And I look at a number of examples, and one of the things that I found was that in almost all of these examples, there was not a scientific consensus. There was actually argument, disagreement, sometimes really, really emotional and vociferous disagreement. So I think your example falls into that disagreement category. Yes, there were definitely people making strong claims for both the biological and the psychoanalytical framework, but I don't think you could say that there was the kind of consensus in psychiatry that we would have, for example, today about the reality of global warming.
So we had a little conversation sort of when we were waiting in the wings for this event about this issue of consensus. And I talked about the fact that the late 1970s, when the psychoanalysts are in the process of basically self-destructing for reasons we couldn't get into, but we don't have to get into, there's a felt sense, particularly now spearheaded by the biological psychiatrists, that we need to, we need to clean house. And particularly we need to clean house around our diagnostic categories, because we're doing this and that, and 70% of the time, same psychiatrists looking at the same patient don't agree on what actually is wrong with this patient. And so most of you, or maybe all of you, have heard of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM. The DSM was a project in achieving consensus. It was a project that was really, sweated out in a whole series of small committees to say that at what minimum what we need to do is at least agree that when we see a patient presenting with these sets of symptoms, that this is what we'll call that patient. And they achieved it because the field was in such a state of dysphoria and crisis.
Not to psychoanalyze.
I meant that in the colloquial sense. But they got that through. And the DSM then becomes the foundation for the new biological psychiatry. Right. And the problem that then emerges was that consensus didn't mean validity.
Hmm. Right. And I think there was another problem. I think Anne is a very big problem for you, actually, which is
I think we love that in a collegiate way.
Well, I feel like a lot of your book is that there was consensus after consensus after consensus that didn't turn out to be correct. In fact, I mean, the DSM had homosexuality as a pathology, right? And there were several other examples as well. And so consensus, in fact, is not enough.
Go
for it.
So two things. First of all, again, the distinction between science and medicine. A medical practitioner has got to make a diagnosis, and they do need to have at least some degree of agreement because, otherwise an insurance company won't pay for it. So there's a kind of pressure.
That was a lot of the reason. The insurance companies were saying, why should we reimburse? It's in the 70s, there was a recession in the U.S., and people are tightening belts. Why should we fund this? And pharmaceutical companies are saying, how can we test our drugs if we don't know that everyone's suffering?
So this means that there are some real reasons to be concerned about certain kinds of things that happen in medicine that don't necessarily spill over into, I mean, I don't like the expression basic science, but I'll use it here for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my book is about trying to identify what these things actually are. So I want to say psychiatry, because of all these complicated issues about patient suffering, about insurance claims, there's a need for them to agree upon diagnoses that puts them into this position. But the other and more thing, it's an enforced consensus. So one of the things I argue both here and in shameless plug, my other but more academic book that I don't expect too many people here to read. But if you really care about this issue, mm-hmm. I have another book. It's a kind of companion volume. It's called Discerning Experts. And it actually looks specifically at this question of what do scientists do when they get together and try to achieve consensus about climate change or DSM or whatever it is. Well, in this book, we're looking at environmental issues. And one of the things we say in that book, and I reiterate here, is enforced consensus is a really bad idea. Right? What consensus in science should be, ideally, is an emergent property. That when scientists come to agreement naturally because they have concluded that there is enough evidence to say that, yes, indeed, we know that this is true, then consensus emerges. And that's what we have seen happen over the reality of climate change, the reality mm-hmm. of moving continents, the reality that DNA carries hereditary information. And we look at those cases, we actually find very few problems, very few examples where those kinds of consensus have been overturned. So it is really important for scientists to know, what I argue is scientists should not view consensus as a goal that they need to achieve. They should view it as, we do our work, and if a consensus emerges, great, and if it doesn't, then we keep working. But scientists doing basic science have the luxury to say, we're not ready to write a DSM of chemistry or the equivalent, whereas physicians are in a different, and I would argue, more difficult situation. So, which is only to say, so patients probably have some reason to be more skeptical about medical practice than they might you know, for chemistry, and we could talk about why nutrition is problematic.
Let's not even do nutrition.
Yeah, okay. Just
don't
panel.
Listen to it. Yes, Anne, go ahead.
I mean, what I would say about the DSM was I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, you could make an argument that once it was produced that they sent it out to all the run-of-the-mill psychiatrists, and this is the new sort of orthodoxy, but the process by which they came to these conclusions wasn't imposed by a single person.
No,
down.
No, but they felt
there
the
was
need.
But what I do think, you know, and it is sort of helpful for us to, as we think about our, you know, our different projects. What was specific or unique about this project is they were creating these categories in the absence of a biological understanding of any of these disorders. They were creating empty cells that they would then fill up. They hoped once they could at least agree that they were looking at the same kind of object, they would then fill up these things with new explanations. And through that process, they would see which were of these categories weren't in fact valid and which were. So it was a promissory note. It was a promise mm-hmm. of science to come. Mm-hmm. And the problem that happened is that it didn't happen fast enough. And in order to get the funding, and in order to persuade the public that they needed to be in charge, because look what the Freudians had done to them. Yeah. And it wasn't just Oedipal. It was, you know, a whole generation of mother blaming and, you know, deinstitutionalization. The Freudians had a lot to answer for. But why should the biological psychiatrists be in charge? It had to be on the basis of they were going to bring science back. Right. But they didn't yet have
the
science.
Yeah.
So then the thought was, well, then we have the decade of the brain, and that's when it all happened. But there wasn't enough funding, and you know, and so on. Mm-hmm. And then if you talk to psychiatrists today, and in terms of like who we should trust, there's a lot of psychiatrists I trust. And a lot of they're the ones that are most humble. They're the ones that have the humility. Mm-hmm. You know, so I have a friend and colleague, Stephen Hyman, who I quote in the book. I like him a lot and I trust him. And he tells me it's going to be 40 years before the science is in a position, he's interested in schizophrenia, he's doing big data research on the genetics of schizophrenia, to really have any kind of, you know, practical implications for patients. But patients are suffering now.
Right.
And that's the dilemma. But, you know, there's a lot of good people. And one of the things that, you know, that are trying to work, and there are people that you do want to be really skeptical about. But one of the things we can do at minimum is at least be honest about the state of the science, of the medicine, of the treatment, and find out, like, what can we do that would help now, given that it might be 40
right.
years before we get the genetics under, you know,
right.
What helps now?
Although I was interested to see, so at the end of your book, you play a little bit with potential solutions.
Yeah.
And one is to kind of reorient psychiatry a little bit so that it focuses on the most severely mentally ill people, and then also that it could be a little more patient-oriented and humble in terms of the psychiatrists, you know, cede some ground to therapists and to other people who don't necessarily have an MD. But I was interested that you didn't propose that really the fundamental problem is that neuroscience isn't there. And Steve Hyman would say that before anybody, that it's been such a tough nut to crack. And so why not say we need to pour resources into brain science?
Well, I don't think that I don't say that.
No, you don't say we shouldn't.
But I'm really interested in, you know, what would help now. So take Tom Insel.
Yeah.
Tom Insel was the director of the NIMH during the the National Institute of Mental Health. And he was all about your point. Like, he poured, you know, more than $1.5 billion into neuroscience research. He's also the one who in 2013 calls out the American Psychiatric Association and says, the DSM, biology never read this book.
Yeah.
This book that was supposed to be the basis, it's gotten in our way.
Yeah. Helpful for research,
the NIMH isn't going to use it anymore, he says. We're going to do something else. And he spends and he pours more and more money into the neuroscience. And then he comes to but he realizes it's not helping people now. You know, they're not moving the needle. Mm-hmm. The challenges of particularly the most severely mentally ill. And so what he does in, I think it's about 2016, 2017, is he just walks out the door. He goes to work for Google. And now he is the president, founding president of a startup that is interested in using basically smartphone technology to assess people's sort of level of mental distress. He's basically, neuroscience didn't do it for him. Now, it doesn't mean that we should give up on neuroscience at all. But I do think that, you know, this is not a time to, for tunnel vision. It's a time to say what, you know, it's time to broaden out and to ask what do we know from the social sciences? What do we even know from those terrible Freudians about, say, human relationships and the therapeutic context within which people get well? People get well even when the science isn't there sometimes.
Yeah, it's true.
And so one of the things I've thought is that the placebo effect, which turns out to be one of the reasons why the pharmaceutical industry is abandoning psychopharmacology these days,
right.
Because
the placebo effect is so big. Yeah.
But you know, instead of seeing this as a crisis, this is the low-hanging fruit. What does this teach us? Mm-hmm. The fact that you can get almost as well taking a placebo antidepressant as a active agent antidepressant, what does that teach us, and what do we learn from that? Mm-hmm. And is that neuroscience? Well, the brain's going to be involved,
Bradley.
But who do we need to marshal to understand that?
Mm-hmm. Naomi, do you want to comment on, I mean, it's basically science that isn't there yet, and yet you have to do the best that you can.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of things in this. So I just want to read a sentence from my own book, if I might. So in chapter two, I try to draw what some of the lessons are from the examples that I look at, where scientists maybe made mistakes, did it wrong. In hindsight, we would say they got it wrong. And I say, if the history of science teaches anything, it's humility. So, I mean, there it is. We know that if anybody's promising the moon, you should be cautious. And you should always, if you want to be an informed consumer of whether it's science or medicine, obviously we have to be asking questions. And one of the key questions, so I have a whole discussion in the book about evidence. One of the key questions should always be, what is the evidence? And this is why when I give public talks about climate change, I go to great pains to talk about what the evidence is. Because I don't think scientists should just be saying, trust us, we're experts. I think scientists need to explain, to say, here's what we know and here's how we know it. Here's why we've come to these conclusions. And I think if people had asked those questions about some of the people you talk about, we might have realized that actually the empirical basis for some of these claims was kind of thin, right?
Yeah.
And that might have been a little bit of a, you know, let's say pink flag, not necessarily red flag, but just to be a little cautious. And so I think that we can be informed consumers. And, you know, I think journalists can play a role here too. You know, I've heard lots of interviews with scientists on a science program where some scientist is, you know, making some big claims and the journalist is gushing, you know, and the journalist doesn't say, well,
what about
the evidence for that claim? What is this based on? And I think that's the key question that we should all be asking. And I think when we ask that question, a lot of these things start to sort themselves.
So then, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, let me speak about, you know, the pink flag or the red flag, you know, and talk again, I'll come back to this question of, like, where's the science in psychiatry? And make a move that maybe will surprise everyone, because there was some excellent science in psychiatry in the 19... But, you know, the real heyday was not the 80s, it was the 50s. The 50s was when people discovered...
they were, like, stumbling on drugs, right?
Hmm?
They were stumbling on drugs.
They were stumbling on drugs, and the drugs then served, or some of the drugs served as experimental tools that allowed people to understand that there were these things called neurotransmitters, and that the drugs affected the reuptake of some of these neurotransmitters in ways that helped you understand how they might work. So dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, these are very recent discoveries. These are discoveries of the middle years of the 20th century. And so the idea that the brain is a chemical system emerges out of that. Two Nobel Prizes come out of this work. The problem is that the work was really, it was animal research that explained what it explained. It explained how the drugs work, among other things. It didn't explain didn't allow you to say that when people have too little, say, of norepinephrine or serotonin, taking the drugs is going to sort of like fill up the tank, like, you know. People go beyond what, you know, so there was actually some very good science, and then there was some very irresponsible extensions and claims made on the basis of that.
And so this brings us to one more way that Anne is a problem for Naomi.
I think
she already needs to take her out for a drink. Conflict makes copy. I know. You need to get us fighting. But all right, go ahead.
In your book, you also bring us up to the present day. And one of the great concerns is that money has flowed into psychiatry, particularly drug company money. And that, in fact, when you talk about evidence, quite a bit of the evidence is tainted because it's clinical trials by companies that are interested in a particular outcome. And so once again, it seems to me that psychiatric science might actually be problematic for trust in science, because one of the big messages going out to the public is, don't trust this. This is drug company money trying to sell you pharmaceuticals.
Well, can I answer that? Because this is really like the thrust of so much of my other work. I mean, so much of my work in science and history of science and the politics of science has been about exactly this issue. So this is where I think it's crucial for scientists to clean their own house. Because if scientists don't address this issue, then the public will be skeptical, and rightly so. Mm-hmm. Because you're absolutely right. We have reams of evidence. We have empirical evidence studies that tell us that even though scientists think they're objective and scientists think that they're not influenced by their funders, it's just not true. And we have lots of evidence to show that that's true, and even evidence to show that even very modest amounts of money, even small gifts, can influence,
absolutely.
Coffee cups. I mean, it's actually frightening how little it takes to influence people.
I don't know what this is.
Yeah, I know. I'm carrying my, this is the World Conference of Science Journalists.
And I'm looking at the Boston Book Festival, so
But of course, I guess they just want me to talk to journalists. But anyway, so this is a real problem, and we have to think really hard about that, and we have to think about who are the sources of funding in certain areas of science, and how could they be influencing the outcomes? Mm-hmm. And scientists have got to get on board on this issue, in my opinion, because if they don't, then I think the public will increasingly just say a plague on all their houses. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it will be the scientific community's own fault.
So what do we do? This is a genuine question. What do we do if the funding of, say, new pharmaceutical research, you know, is going to come from the private sector largely?
Because the NIH money's down, flat.
Can I answer that? Because I think there's two things. First of all, I mean, it is true that part of the reason so much money for pharmaceutical research is now coming from has been the decline in public funding for scientific research. And so a lot of us sort of just accept that as, oh, well. But I don't think we have to accept that. I mean, it's a political question, and we ought to be raising it as a political question. And the scientific community shouldn't be just saying, oh, it's fine, or university presidents and provosts saying, oh, it's fine, we'll make public-private partnerships, it's all great. No, it's not all great. And so university presidents ought to be in the front lines of fighting back to work for, certainly public funding of science, but if you can't get that, then at least philanthropical funding through foundations that are not pushing particular drugs. Mm-hmm. And we've had a lot of excellent, you know, like Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, there's a lot of excellent foundation funding. And honestly, before the World War II, most scientific funding in the United States came from foundations, not the federal government. So there are choices, and we don't have to just say, oh, we have to take money from the pharmaceutical industry. The second thing is disclosure. A lot of universities and journals have been appallingly slow to have strict rules about disclosure, and we saw that last week. I don't know how many of you heard about the big article that was on the front page of lots of newspapers. It was covered on, you know, lots of radio stations. The article in the Annals of Internal Medicine that claimed that eating red meat is fine.
Yeah. Oh my God,
don't worry about it. Just keep eating the same amount of red meat you've always been eating. Well, first of all, it was a highly methodologically questionable study. Lots of things to question about how that study was done. But a bigger question is, why did the Annals of Internal Medicine publish that study without disclosing that most of the authors had ties to the food industry, including the pork and beef industry, and many of them had extensive ties? One of the lead authors had taken a large amount of money recently from the sugar industry, and none of this was disclosed.
No.
So how is that even possible in 2019? So there are big questions that need to be asked about journal policy, university policies, and disclosure is not a panacea, but it's certainly a first step in allowing the public, the readers, and journalists to make informed decisions about whether this information is likely to be trustworthy or not.
I completely agree. And I remember I started the beginning of my remarks about talking about why But we live in such a polarized sort of world, or so far as mental health or thinking about mental health is. And one of the big reasons has to do with the dark days of the 90s and in the first decade of the new millennium in psychiatry, when a really large number of researchers and clinicians not only just took research money, but also basically became employees of the pharmaceutical company.
Spoke on behalf of the drugs.
They became key opinion leaders, but were clearly understood by the industry to be only worth keeping on the payroll if they could boost profits. Now, it's a messy big story, but there is a legitimate reason why people get so angry with psychiatrists, and that's an important, that the roots of it lie importantly in the 90s and new millennium.
Yeah, and maybe it was a tactical mistake on my part. I didn't talk about that a lot in this book, because Merchants of Doubt, I mean, that book is all about that, so I sort of felt like, kind of been there, done that, wanted to look at cases where there wasn't sort of obvious and egregious bias. And even without obvious and egregious bias, we still have issues that we have to look at. And so I try to do that in this book, but I was trying to, in a way, to look at what I thought were the harder cases, because, you know, money, I mean, we know money corrupts. That's not exactly a big surprise. You know? I didn't really feel like I needed to write a whole book about that.
But I don't think it's just, you know, I think there's still
it's
more to say.
Of course.
For sort of 20 years, the pharmaceutical industry marketed the heck out of its existing vault of drugs. And then when they were close to running off patent, they did what some people call disease mongering. They looked in the DSM and said, well, antidepressants, we know that often, we had FDA approval for them for depression, but we know that often depression is accompanied by feelings of anxiety. Maybe we can run some clinical trials and see whether we can get the FDA to extend our patent, now targeted to a form of anxiety. And so this is why Zoloft starts off being an antidepressant. Have you ever seen the Zoloft, for people of a certain age, the Zoloft cute blob?
The little
blob. And back in like 2002, the Zoloft blob is depressed in a cave, whimpering, and then the bluebird comes out after he takes the drug. But then about 4 years later, this same Zoloft blob shows up at a party.
With social anxiety.
And all blushing. And then they take this, and the same announcer sort of says, you take this. This is disease mongering. But the reason it's happening is there's nothing new coming through the pipeline. So, I mean, you can compare that to, like, the cancer formula, you know, the oncology, the incredible energy around new treatment options around for various forms of cancer. Now, that's still a profit-driven industry, but I don't think we feel quite the same way.
Because you can't disease-monger cancer.
Well, I don't know. You can certainly overhype it. But a big problem for psychiatry has been the paucity of new options, and this comes back to the paucity of the science.
Right. So let's pause there. Let's go to your questions. Please wait. Please raise your hand if you have one. We have a microphone in the audience. There's some over here. There's one right back there. Who has the mic? Oh, there you go. Yes. So, sorry, we'll get over to the left-hand corner next, but let's just go here first. Yes. Oh, and I always should remind you, please keep it brief and make it a question, not a statement. I mean, could start with a statement.
So it seems like there's a regressionary period in science right now, in medical science especially. I think one of the biggest examples is vaccines and links to autism, which are based on a discredited study at this point. And so for Why Trust Science, I guess my question is, for those of us who trust science, how do we convince other people to trust science when they're basing their opinions on things that have, you know, through consensus been discredited?
Great question. This is yours.
Yeah, well, obviously the short answer is you buy this book and you give them a copy, preferably a signed copy from me, and you tell them they can feel free to email me their questions. But, I think this gets back to what I talked about earlier. It's not enough just to say to people, oh, we know autism doesn't, you know, vaccines don't cause autism. You have to explain why we know it. And I found in my own experience, sometimes even just the smallest amount of explanation can be effective, because often people are upset because they just feel like, you know, scientists are you know, don't explain things properly, or they don't take the time to explain it. And often, you know, I mean, one of the questions I get constantly is, how do we know climate change isn't caused by the sun? Because this is a very popular denialist talking point. And so then I explain it to people, and they're like, oh, okay, great. And one time even I was, some years ago, I was with my daughter, who was about 15 at the time, and she had been dealing with something at school where some kid was giving her pushback. So she says to me, Mom, how do we know it's not the sun? And so we're in a restaurant with a paper tablecloth. So I quickly do a little model of the atmosphere. I explain to her the difference between the stratosphere and the troposphere and how we know this. And as I'm finishing this explanation with pen and paper on the paper tablecloth, I realize that the people at the tables next to us are listening in. So, you know, this is the point. And if you find yourself, if you're a school teacher or someone who finds themselves in this situation, then yeah, you know, do some homework, learn some stuff, and answer people's questions, because most people actually would like to know the truth. And if you are willing to just spend a little time in a non-condescending way to explain it, a lot of times that goes a long way.
Maybe also alongside that, you know, it's helpful to try to engage respectfully the source of their fears.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
You know, I'm a mom, and what if the science is wrong? You know, yeah. The cost of my trusting the scientists, if they're wrong, you know, could be catastrophic.
So
I think, you know, there could be a way, there's emotional work as well as intellectual work to be done, I think, around
absolutely.
This.
And a big part of Merchants of Doubt, the whole thing that Eric Conway and I were trying to understand in that book was, why would intelligent people reject climate science? And so there we actually came up with the answer. It had to do with their commitments to free market economics and certain fears and anxieties about the government taking over their lives. And so it is possible to decouple those issues and to say, well, yeah, I hear you. I don't want my taxes to go up either. But climate change is a real problem. And if we don't deal with it, actually the costs will get higher.
Yeah, what's your good. Short version of your answer on vaccines?
Oh, how do we know they don't cause autism? The main reason is because we have very good clinical studies, particularly from Denmark. In Denmark, they keep extremely good medical records. You don't have to have vaccination in Denmark, but doctors have to keep records of whether their patients have accepted or refused vaccination. So we have extremely good data, and what we see from that data is that people who have not had vaccinations, those children have no higher rates of autism than the people who have had vaccinations.
So the rates are the same.
Right. It makes no difference. Mm-hmm. So you can have vaccinations or not, and it makes no difference whatsoever in the rate of autism.
And this is among millions.
Among millions and millions of people over many decades. Yeah. Right.
That would be very reassuring. So in that way, the emotional work can sometimes be done through the intellectual work.
But like you said, I mean, Seth Mnookin's book on this is very good, The Panic Virus. One of the things he talks about in that book, and it relates to your psychiatry issues, people whose children have autism, these people are in pain, they're suffering, their children have a really debilitating situation, and medical science has not a lot to offer them. So if some charlatan comes along and says, well, I can offer you something, I can offer you chelation therapy, you can see why people would be tempted by that.
Mm-hmm. Great. Who has the mic? Anybody?
Yeah, we're there.
Whoever has it, please ask. Oh, okay. Questions? Sorry, I didn't see your hands yet. Right here, and then we'll go over to this side.
I was wondering if you could talk a little about the impact that the pharmaceutical industry had on the psychiatry profession in the 1950s.
The 50s?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, because the aura around the pharmaceutical industry was very different then. The view was that in the media post-World War II era that the industries were creating all of these new wonder drugs that finally were allowing medicine to do things and cure people in ways that had never been possible before. I think one of the more striking sort of developments between the 50s and the 90s is how the reputation of the pharmaceutical industry as profit-driven and corrupt sort of develops. It wasn't seen that way in the 1950s. You had scientists who were employed by the pharmaceutical industry who become very prominent figures in very mainstream science, and no one suggests then that they've been corrupted.
That the pharma reputation got so bad?
Well, I think it's partly because they are forced to privilege marketing over R&D.
And when they recruit, forced to? Hmm? Why were they forced to?
Because there was nothing new coming through the pipeline. They were busy tweaking around the edges. And then they recruit the psychiatrists to as sort of extensions of their marketing. And that was really a terrible thing to do.
Over here, question.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
Hey there. So to speak metaphorically, the tool of science is the microscope and the glass slide. It's tools of precision. I think that in the case of mental illness, correct me if I'm wrong, we found something particularly evasive for these types of tools of isolation. My question is about what is it that we're either already doing or that we need to be doing within science to perhaps take a more integrative approach to understanding mental illness, to include things like social context, cultural norms. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You've started to answer the question yourself, haven't you?
Yeah,
The thing about, I believe, about mental illness is that it affects our identity, it affects our relationships. We can have a diseased kidney, and we're the same person with a diseased kidney, usually. But mental illness changes the way that people perceive us, the way we perceive others. And the brain, the human brain, is a social brain. And so, this sort of idea, there's the psychotherapist on the one side and the biologist on the other, somewhere down the road, people are going to realize how silly that was. Because we're having a kind of conversation right now, and something's happening in your brain and something's happening in mine. And the brain of mentally ill people or mentally suffering people is still an intensely social brain. So I do think that, trying to understand, where I would go first would be, trying to understand the ways that the human brain does respond to social context and social relationships. This is why I think the placebo effect, as I mentioned before, would be just, it's just hanging there, waiting for us to understand what it's trying to teach us.
And I want to put in a plug for Anne. Her book on the placebo effect is so interesting. So
I've written about the placebo effect.
I mean, Anne's written a lot of interesting books. But if I could also add to that. So one of the things I tried to do in my book was, in these cases where we would say in hindsight that scientists got it wrong, to try to figure out what went wrong. And so I'm not an expert in mental illness or psychiatry, but one of the cases I look at is the history of the contraceptive pill and the way in which...
And depression.
And the way in which physicians discounted the early reports of patients, women, who were experiencing mental health effects from being on hormonal contraception. And so one of the arguments I make is that evidence comes in many different forms. So you're right, and I like the way you started your talk with metaphorically about the slide, but it is important to emphasize that that's a metaphor, because in reality, scientific evidence comes in many different forms, which includes things like patients reporting on their own experience.
Yeah.
But there has been a tendency in at least some branches of medicine and biomedical science to discount people's experiences. And I talk about one particular case where a medical journalist describes them as iffy, So I don't think that people's personal experiences are iffy. I think people's personal experiences are exactly what they are, or I like to think of as they're scientific studies where N equals one. And in the book, I actually talk about my own personal experience of taking a pill and becoming depressed. And I know I wasn't crazy, right? So the point is evidence comes in many different forms. And it's really incumbent upon scientists to be paying attention to the different forms of evidence, even if some of them aren't as rigorous as test tubes or RCTs, they're still evidence. And in the cases where things went wrong in the past, one of the things we often see is that there was some kind of evidence that a lot of scientists were discounting, but some scientists or some physicians were saying, no, don't discount it. There's something going on here. And so I think that's a really important lesson for all of us. Mm-hmm.
The different types of evidence. Question here, and then we'll go towards the back.
So for Why Trust Science, you talk about how doctors should open up and explain the data and so on, right? So the same thing happened with the internet, right? Where all the information became available to people, and people were able to receive all the information. So, and the reaction to that was that people sort of like had a confirmation bias, and sort of looked at the data and agreed with the data that supported their information. How does this opening to doctors sort of? How is it different?
Okay, well, a couple of different things there. First of all, I'm not really talking about doctors. I mean, I don't study medicine, I study science, and so most of my analysis and my advice is about science, and it's about how scientists should communicate, and it's about how we as the public should understand the communications we receive from scientists. So that's, I think, an important decision, because I think in a clinical setting there are other different considerations and constraints. In terms of the internet, again, I want to just slightly modify what you said. I'm not saying that people need to put all the data on the internet and just have a kind of chaos free-for-all. That's not my argument. My argument is about explaining the why of conclusion. So it's what you just asked me. If we say we know that vaccinations do not cause a higher rate of autism, and then you say, well, how do we know that? And I say, well, because of the Danish studies. And there's other evidence too, but that's the best and most compelling of the studies. So it's not about putting the raw data on the internet for anybody to just, you know, data mine. It's about explaining the reasoning and the logic and the sorts of evidence that we have. And it could be that I would tell you that, and maybe you would say, well, I don't trust the Danes or something, right? I mean, it's not like that's the end of the story, right? But it's about explaining the basis for claims. So I hope that distinction is clear, because I think it's actually quite different than an argument for just, you know, 100% data transparency, which might be useful in some cases, but that's not what I'm arguing here.
But supposing it was a doctor, I mean, that's sort of, and supposing, you know, you go in to see, supposing you are, you know, paralyzed with just, you can't get out of bed in the morning, you just can't, the thoughts are racing about, you're going to, say you're a college student, I don't know if you are, but let's say for the hypothetical, I know, and you're going to fail everything, and your parents going to be, you know, and you can't get out of bed, and you stop, you're not eating, and someone drags you off to see a psychiatrist or a mental health worker, and what should you trust? What should you do? So the suffering is real. And I take very, you know, when I teach my students, you know, I teach CJ psychiatry, I'm very clear that you always take mental suffering very seriously. Not all mental suffering is necessarily the sign of a disordered brain. So I, you know, mental suffering is a bigger category. And yet, if you're in a crisis, you know, I also have come to believe that sometimes medication can stabilize even if you don't have a disease. Just like in the example I mentioned in the book, like if a woman is in labor, being in labor isn't a form of sickness, but you're in a lot of pain and you might want to take a pain reliever to get through it. What you should trust kind of depends on, you know, what the question you're asking. So if you're saying, do I have a chemical imbalance, doc? And that, you know, that's one kind of a question. And I would, you know, and then you would need to be, I think, quite skeptical about the response, because that person has no idea if you have a chemical imbalance and know that they've taken your cerebral spinal fluid. And, but if the question is, could this help me now get through this? Then I think there's different kinds of evidence that could help you. So I do think some granularity around these things could, you know, is really important, because I certainly wouldn't want the lesson of mind fixers to be that you shouldn't seek help if you're suffering.
But I think there's a circular problem here, because, like you talk about in the book, informed trust. Mm-hmm. And yet, trust by its nature, we have to trust the experts that we go to, that they know, in fact, better than we do, except about our own state, evidence is.
But you see, one of the things that I think could help is if patients were part of the consensual process, and then they are, rather than we have these experts and the patients sort of show up and, you know, either trust or don't trust. Are we stopping, or we need to get another question? I can stop.
No, sorry.
Sorry, I don't mean any.
While you talk. Go ahead.
No, I've lost my train. I'm all embarrassed now.
Sorry, that was totally my bad. Let's take another question.
There are companies that claim to, once you have a DNA swab from the cheek, that they can analyze a person's genome, and based on that, they can tell how a person might metabolize a certain drug over another. Mm-hmm. Is there some validity to those claims?
Are you looking at me? I don't think so. I don't think so, because if they were, then the pharmaceutical industry would be doing this kind of personalized, you know, pharmaceutical targeted marketing and development, and they're not able to do that.
In terms of psychiatric drugs.
Yeah, I mean, that's where, you know, in terms of, so are they talking about like also, maybe there's other fields of medicine where they can do that. But I think personalized medicine is in very early stages.
Yeah, if I could just chime in one other thing. Probably the most important part of my argument, which we haven't talked about, is that my argument is that the fundamental basis for trust in science is not the test tubes or the microscope slides, but it's the process of vetting that scientists go through to vet claims, to demand evidence, to, really interrogate claims in a rigorous way, peer review, and all of that. And so that means that any new claim should be viewed with skepticism. And so my view is that anything you hear that's brand new and like the latest thing, if you're suffering from a potentially fatal illness and it's the only possibility, then you may want to go with something that's, experimental, because you may not have a choice.
Yeah.
But for anything other than a fatal disease, you really don't want to be trusting any brand new claim, because it means science hasn't really had a time to sort it out. And so I think of science as being a bit like good red wine. It takes time for the science to mature and ripen. But once that time has passed and you've had the opportunity for the tannins to settle, metaphorically speaking, then it probably is, in most cases, trustworthy.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's a question over here. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, back there and then up here.
You might have pretty different answers considering how you've talked about either medicine or what you said was badly referred to as basic science. But I wonder who you might think has the most agency in improving the public's relationship with science in general, and what do you maybe expect for the future of that, and what do you propose?
I think it's a great question.
Yeah, that is a great question.
So I would start with the media. Just off that, because looking at, sorry, no offense. because one of the things I was really struck by during some of the, looking at some of the darker sort of episodes in the history of psychiatry is how a credulous, the lobotomy story, for example, but, how the media, and this is, you've made this point, before, that the media tends to, again, the media has its own agendas. It needs to, it wants people
to,
it wants an audience. It wants people to buy the newspapers. And so, I think the media, is someplace to look, because that's where a lot of people, even, in the sort of digital world, it's still media, a lot of people get their first information.
Yeah, the media has plenty to answer for, but since we're here with the media and I have one of my nice night fellows in the audience here, I'm going to give a slightly different answer. I do think that the media does damage by running, with the sort of surprising gotcha kind of story, like the red meat story or the dental floss story, which I talk about in the book. But I think that the scientific community blames the media too much. Mm. And because I think that we, and by we, I'm going to say broadly, because I do consider myself a scientist as well as a historian of science, we have some responsibility here because of how little work we actually do to answer questions like, well, how do we know that vaccinations don't cause autism? And this came home to me really strongly this week when I said on Science Friday, even if that meat study wasn't tainted, tainted meat. even if those guys didn't have links to the meat industry, it's one study against a backdrop of a huge amount of data that we now have from population studies, from animal studies, from epidemiology about good nutrition. And everyone always says that nutrition's incredibly complicated. And, in a way it is, the details are, but in a way it's not really. And so I said, there's this huge amount of evidence. And so I get an email after Science Friday is over from someone says, okay, where can I find that huge amount of evidence that you just referred to? And I thought, well, see, there's a good question, because it's actually very difficult. There's no one place that I can send a person to. So what I think, this is my proposal, I think the scientific societies, and particularly the National Research Council, National Academy of Sciences, AAAS, ought to be spending money, taking time to write reports designed for ordinary people that would summarize the scientific evidence on these key issues. And they've done it for evolutionary biology because it became such a big issue for science teachers. We could do it for nutrition. We could do it for autism. And it wouldn't even be that hard.
Sort of like a Consumer Reports.
Consumer Reports for Science. Yeah. There's an opportunity for us.
There is a thing called the Center for Science in the Public Interest that puts out something called Nutrition Action.
Yeah.
And they do that. They will do that. Well, here's the vast consensus on meat
true.
Or something like that. But and they have a couple million subscribers.
I think that's good, but I think there would be a certain credibility if it came from, you know, the National Academy of Sciences, let's say.
Yes, right? I totally agree. Last question back there. And I apologize to everyone. I'm so sorry. It was so nice. There are so many questions. I'm really sorry to all the people we didn't get to.
Can we stay up a little bit longer if people want to come up and talk to us?
Yes.
No, we have to go to a book signing.
No, you'll be downstairs.
All right.
Don't listen to her.
If you didn't get a chance to ask your question, please come down to the book signing and you can ask there.
First of all, thank you for coming out. It's a pleasant evening here. One of the main crucial aspect of scientific process is replicability, right? And in the past 2 years, there's a study, a huge study that came out that within behavioral psychology, 2/3 of the study could not be replicable. For Dr. Oreskes, I have a question. If you found a similar problem in different other types of sciences, and for Dr. Harrington, do you have any recommendations about how the scientific ecosystem can basically change that?
Yeah.
Do we have enough incentives, or what kind of incentives do we need to change where we can introduce actual funding for people to just replicate other people's work?
Hmm. Yeah, so I actually talk about this in the book. So the structure of the book is, this was based originally on Tanner lectures that I gave at Princeton. So the structure of the book is that the first two chapters are based on those lectures. And then there's a set of commentary and kind of peer review by a group of commentators, and then I respond to them. One of them is specifically about the replication crisis. And so it turns out that actually the replication crisis has been hugely exaggerated. And the media do have some role to play, but it's not just the media.
It's Charlie Anidi's fault.
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, there are some areas of science, particularly in psychology, where this whole issue of p-hacking was identified. And there's no question that there are some real issues to do with the misuse of statistics, particularly in psychology, but in some other areas as well. But the claim that this is a broad problem in all science is not supported by the scientific evidence. And in fact, the few studies that have really tried to look at this systematic suggest that the retraction rate in science is actually tiny, far, probably like far
it's
worse.
Like 0.01%.
Yeah, 0.02, I think it was. I mean, tiny. And actually, if you compare that to the error rate in, you know, car manufacturing or almost anything else you can think of, it's unbelievably small. So it's actually telling us that science is kind of amazingly good. And then in terms of the specific issue of replication in cancer research, which is where one thing that got a lot of press was this Amgen study. And again, I would say it's one study, right? So I don't know how much credence you want to put on any one study, but I went and read that famous Amgen study where they took a set of studies that were looking at drugs that were highly touted as possible cancer-curing drugs and claimed that almost none of these studies were replicable. So I went to look at that to figure out what they had done. Guess what? Have you actually read that article? It's an opinion piece in Science magazine. They do not actually present their own data. And they don't because they claim that it's proprietary. So they've made, So they've made this giant claim about the non-replicability of other people's work, and they have not presented their own data. So as far as I'm concerned, that's a completely bogus claim. I don't give it any credibility at all. And when they're prepared to show their data and subject it to peer review, then let's have a conversation.
Well, I think we should end on that feisty note.
That's yours.
All right, mic drop.